All right, so it's 1 o'clock, and this is the Mastery Teach Call. And what we're going to do, I have a special guest, Bill Exeter, from Exeter 1031 Exchange. And I sent out an email that has a PDF on it. So if you got my email, there was a second email that went out. Open the second one, download, and you'll be able to take notes as we go along. So what we're going to do, the call's going to go, Bill's going to teach for a little while, but at any time, at any point, like 2 minutes into the call, 5 minutes in, 15, whenever you want to ask a question, just press *0, and the operator will cue you up for the round and put you in, and we'll get you on the call to ask your question. If you press *0 twice, that means it'll take you out of the queue. So just do it once, and the operator will get you into the queue. So with that, I'm going to have Bill stop the call. So go ahead, Bill.
Thank you so much. Good to have everyone on the call today, and hope we can be of lots of informative information today. So we're going to be talking about 1031 exchange transactions. And what I thought I'd do quickly is just kind of give a quick background on us, what we do, and whatnot, and then kind of from there encourage people to ask questions as we go. We don't want you to forget your questions or anything like that, and absolutely want to take questions as we go. Make sure that you get the answers you would like to get out of this presentation today. So to me, that's the key, is making sure you walk away with the answers you want to your questions. So quick information on who we are. Exeter 1031 Exchange is a qualified intermediary or accommodator. People also call them facilitators. Years and years ago, they used to call us straw people. I was never really a fan of that nickname. but we do all types of 1031 exchanges. We cover all 50 states, and we're going to talk about all of these today. So we do forward 1031 exchanges. That's where you're selling first and reinvesting or buying second. That's what probably 97-98% of investors use, is the forward exchange. We're going to talk about reverse exchanges, where you can buy first and then sell second, and that's the other 2-3% predominantly. Those are more complicated, more involved, but take a lot of the risk out of the 1031 exchange process. We'll talk a little bit about improvement exchanges, where you're buying a replacement property and you want to use some of your exchange funds to improve the property and have it count, all of that count toward your 1031 exchange. And if we have time, we'll talk about zero equity 1031 exchanges. We don't see a whole lot of those today. That's more common during a recession, where the property has dropped in value and it's worth less than what you owe. There's still ways to do a 1031 exchange when you have no equity but still have a taxable gain. So we're going to focus most of our comments today on real property. But 1031 exchanges also apply to personal property. I'm not talking about the primary residence or a second home. Personal property means anything that is not real estate. So we do lots of exchanges on aircraft, shipping, trucking vessels, equipment, baseball franchise teams, contracts, beer distribution rights, and things like that qualify. And we also do exchanges of foreign property, so you can exchange foreign property for foreign property. So that's kind of a quick overview of who we are, and my background has been in the 1031 exchange industry for 33 years. We've been doing it for a long time. So with that, let's jump into it. You know, we get a lot of questions as to, you know, should I do a 1031, should I not do a 1031, and it really boils down to you, your goals, your objectives, what's right for you. There's no black and white answer here. So there's a lot of variables, and it kind of depends on what's right for you. So first thing is, you really want to look at your property and ask yourself those tough questions. Go through your cash flow analysis, et cetera. And, you know, are you getting the kind of cash flow you expect? Are you getting the return that you want? Do you think you still have opportunity for appreciation? You know, analyze the portfolio and ask the question, is this providing what I want? Is it meeting my goals and objectives? And, you know, is it going to provide the growth that you want in the future? And if the answer is no, then maybe it's time to reposition the portfolio somehow to tweak it or adjust it for your goals and objectives. So clients usually fall into three categories, either a diversification strategy, a consolidation strategy, or a repositioning. So diversify is really what a lot of the clients do, especially when they get into real estate, is they buy maybe a single family property and 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, they're ready for a duplex or a fourplex, or maybe sell one and buy 3 or 4 single families. So they're really diversifying by the number of properties or perhaps the geographic area. Sometimes we get people who have all of their assets in one city or county or state, and they decide it's time to really diversify into different areas. They can diversify by asset class type of properties. So maybe they have all single families and they want to get into multi or get into commercial office or who knows what. So all of that you can do through the 1031 exchange without incurring your taxes. You can avoid all your capital gain taxes, your depreciation recapture taxes. And in today's world, we have the Medicare surcharge or the Obamacare tax, which would not kick in as long as you're deferring your gain. Then you get people who usually fall into the consolidation phase when they're getting closer to retirement or in retirement, and they're just tired of the property management headaches. They want to consolidate into fewer properties that are less property management intensive and just easier to take care of. And then you get the overall repositioning strategy where, clients, maybe it's either before or after a recession, and they're repositioning their portfolio to take advantage of the next economic trend. So all of those can be done, and it's all on a tax-deferred basis if you go through the 1031 exchange. Having said that, I would quickly want to touch upon other tax-deferred strategies just quickly. Usually the 1031 is what you hear about, and that's probably the right solution, but not always. So we just want to be kind of upfront and aware of what else is out there, just in case it makes sense. So the 1033 exchange is either condemnation or eminent domain, or it's a natural disaster. So many of you may have had some kind of a natural disaster, fire, flood, hurricane, mudslide, what have you, and it's either partially or completely destroyed your property. You file an insurance claim, you get an insurance check, and you probably take the check and reinvest that money by rebuilding or fixing the property that was damaged. That's actually a 1033 exchange. Most people don't report it like that, but it technically is a 1033 exchange. The reason I bring it up is, you might be negotiating to sell your property to some kind of government agency, either city, county, state, or federal government, and they may have eminent domain authority. So even though it's a regular negotiation, a regular buy-sell, and they're not condemning the property, you actually might want to ask them to condemn the property or threaten you. So it's probably one of those few times where you want the government to threaten you. And if you can show that they said, hey, we're going to buy your property, if you fail to sell it to me, if you fail to close and convey title to us, we're going to take the property from you through eminent domain. If you can show that it was an absolute threat, you qualify for 1033 exchange treatment. And there's pros and cons with the 1033. The 1033 has a much longer time frame to reinvest. So it can be anywhere from 2 to 5 years, depending on the scenario. Where a 1031 exchange only gives you 180 days, which is about 6 months. So you get a longer time frame. You don't need a qualified intermediary. In fact, there's really no way to use a qualified intermediary in a 1033. You can pull cash out and pay tax. That's what my favorite part about a 1033 is. You can actually not reinvest all the cash and not get hit with cash boot. So it's the only exchange transaction where you can pull cash out and it's not a taxable event. The downside is the definition of a like-kind property is a little more specific, a little narrower. So it's not a huge deal, but it's something to be aware of. So that's just a quick overview of 1033s. 1034s were the old exchange of your primary residence. So if you owned a primary residence and you sold it, you had 2 years to roll over your gain by buying another home of equal or greater value. That was taken away in 1997, and it was replaced with the 121 exclusion, which most of you are probably familiar with. That is, if you sell your home and you can say that you've lived in it for 2 out of the last 5 years, you get up to $500,000 tax-free. It's actually $250 per person, $500 for a married couple. So it's a better mousetrap. It's tax-free, not tax-deferred, But in a lot of cases in the country, you've got areas where there's huge appreciation. So if your gain is over 250 or over 500, you may still have a taxable event. There's ways to deal with that. And if we have time at the end, we'll talk about some strategies to combine that with a 1031 exchange. The other two I'm going to pass on for right now. We'll see if we can bring that up later on in the program. So having said all that, let's kind of dive into the actual 1031 exchange itself and the strategy. And I mentioned that we get a lot of questions about when should I use it. And just as important is when should you not use it. So let's talk about that real quick. You know, it's a tax-deferred strategy, so it keeps deferring the tax as long as you keep exchanging. So a lot of investors never want to pay the tax, and so they'll keep exchanging throughout their lifetime. Every time they sell rental or investment property, they structure an exchange and buy and replace it with other rental or investment property. And then when you keep exchanging, and then when you pass on, you leave the property to whomever, your kids, grandkids, or somebody else. And whoever receives that property or inherits that property gets a step up in cost basis. So that means that the capital gain tax goes away, the depreciation recapture tax goes away, and you avoid the Medicare surcharge. So it's what they call a step up in cost basis. So let me give you a quick example of how it works. Let's say years ago you bought property for, $100,000. Today it's worth $1 million. And you pass on. You leave it to your kids. Your kids inherit the property, and their cost basis is stepped up to $1 million. So they literally have a property worth $1 million. Their cost basis is $1 million. They can sell it tomorrow for $1 million and pay zero taxes. So that's that step up in cost basis. We have a kind of a morbid sense of humor, but we call it swap till you drop. So keep exchanging till you pass on and leave it to your, whoever you care to, and then they're going to get that step up in cost basis. So that's usually the best way to take advantage of the 1031 exchange is continually do it throughout your lifetime. It just depends on what your goals and objectives are. Some people just do not want to pass on property to anybody, and they're going to, you know, use the exchange perhaps to slowly trade out of real estate. So we'll talk about reinvestment requirements, but one strategy is to sell for $1 million, buy for, say, $900,000, and pay tax just on the $100,000 you've traded down by, and do that over a period of time to slowly exit the real estate market when you're well into retirement. And not get hit with all of the taxes in 1 year. So that's a potential strategy to slowly get out if you don't want to do that step up in cost basis. So having said all that, let's talk about income taxes. And, you know, tonight the President Trump is giving his first speech in front of joint sessions of Congress. We have no idea what he's going to say. So a lot of this may change over the next couple of months as he rolls out his tax reform stuff. But today we have capital gain tax rates at the federal level of 15% minimum for most of us. And if your adjusted gross income is high enough, you'll be bumped to the 20% rate. And that may likely change as the tax reform, you know, works its way through the legislative process. So keep in mind, it's 15%, maybe 20%. We also have depreciation recapture tax rates. So you've got your rental property. You've been depreciating it over the years, which means every year you write off part of the property as a depreciation deduction on your tax return. And if you ever decide to sell and just cash out, all of that depreciation is added back to your income or recaptured, and it's taxed. And at the federal level, that's 25%. We also have the wonderful Medicare surcharge, or what people call Obamacare tax, and that does not kick in all the time. It depends on your adjusted gross income, but effectively, any interest income, capital gain income, if you've got dividend income, those type of passive incomes, anything above your adjusted gross basis that's over $200,000 if you're single, $250,000 if you're married, is going to be subject to the Obamacare tax, which is the 3.8% surcharge. President Trump has said he is going to get rid of that, so we'll have to wait and see, but today that still applies. So if your AGI is high enough, you might have that to worry about. And then it depends on your state, but you're also going to have state taxes probably. State taxes tend to run, say, 3 to 5%, but some go as high as, you know, like in California where I'm at, where 13.3% is our top tax rate. So you have to factor all of that into it. So that's a quick whirlwind tour on why you would do it. Let's talk about why you might not do it. If you have a loss on the sale of your property for any reason, you wouldn't want to do a 1031 exchange probably, because if you do the exchange, you have to defer the loss. And in most cases, you're going to want to recognize the loss and take it as a write-off on your tax return. There may be other strategic reasons as well where you don't want to recognize, or you do want to recognize the gain, because maybe you'll have loss carry forward or something that can offset your gain. So why defer it? Let's use up the losses now. Those are potential strategies. Again, it's not right for everybody. It just depends on your specific situation. So you have to kind of look at it and ask the question, should you or should you not 1031 exchange? Having said that, let's jump into the mechanical steps. You know, how do you actually structure the 1031 exchange transaction? And the first thing you want to look at is a qualified intermediary. That's what we do at Exeter 1031, is we're a qualified intermediary. The qualified intermediary is going to draft all the legal documents to structure the exchange. They're going to hold the cash proceeds, your equity, between the sale and your ultimate reinvestment or purchase. And I think one of the most important parts is to help advise you and your advisors on how to structure these. Many exchange companies will not help work with your advisors and guide you and give you a kind of consultation on what to do. And with our expertise, I think that's important. So you're looking for a qualified intermediary that can help you kind of get through this, answer questions, keep you in compliance with the process. Most importantly, you have to make sure that you get the exchange put in place before anything closes. Once your transaction, either the sale or the buy, closes, there's no way to make it part or structured as part of the 1031 exchange at that point. So everything has to be in place before closing. That's one of the major requirements. We get calls every week where people have already closed and they're trying to do an exchange.
When we did our 1031 exchanges, we didn't put it in the letter of intent because you didn't want the seller to know that you were in the process of 1031 if you were moving forward with it. Or if, when we were selling our properties, we waited until we went to purchase and sale, and that's when we put it in there. So we wouldn't be showing our cards as we were going along. So just remember that. And if you have any questions as we go along, just press *0 and we'll get you right into the queue. The operator will get you right into the queue to ask questions. I just wanted to add that, Bill.
Sure, that's an excellent point. You know, there's a lot of information on the internet that says you have to include language in your contracts or you have to notify the other parties, but it doesn't say when you have to do that. So that's an excellent point. Most people think you have to build it into the contract up front, and that's not true. So from a strategic perspective, if you disclose it's an exchange too quickly, you're right on point. They could use that against you, especially on the buy side. If they know you're an exchange and you've identified their property, and they might try to back out and get you to pay a higher price. That's an excellent point. Be very careful when you disclose what you're doing. And if anybody you're working with says you have to put the language in up front, that is not true. That's actually a fallback to pre-1991 days where nobody knew how to structure an exchange and the IRS hadn't issued regulations yet, and they wanted to make sure everything was integrated. And so that's where that language comes from in the purchase and sale agreements, but it's not required today. As long as you have your qualified intermediary involved, everything will be in good shape. Let's jump into a couple areas where there's a lot of gray area. And this is where, you know, you can read stuff on the internet and there's all sorts of opinions, but the way they draft things, they make it sound like it's fact. So this is where I'm going to try to, you know, explain the differences here. So the first one is qualified use. And that means that the property you're selling and the property you're buying have to be held for either some type of rental income, cash flow, or has to be held for investment or capital appreciation, or it can be used in a trade or business. And the critical component is your intent to hold for rental, investment, or business use. So we get lots of calls literally every day, hundreds of calls every day, where people will say things like, well, I understand I don't qualify for 1031 exchange treatment because I've only held title for maybe 8 months. And the length of time has no bearing on whether or not you qualify. So when you hear people say it has to be 12 months or more, or you know, 24 months or something like that. Those are opinions. Those are not requirements. The key is your intent. Did you have and can you prove you had the intent to hold for rental or investment purposes? Now, obviously, the longer you hold title to the property and the longer you rent it out or use it as investment or business property, the easier it is to prove intent. That's why people say 12 months or 24 months, what have you. But literally, if you buy property through an exchange, you close on it, the next day somebody emails you and says, hey, I would pay you double what you bought that property for because I wanted it and didn't get it. If you accept that offer, but you can show you had the intent to hold it for investment property, but you just got this offer out of the blue, that would qualify. It's difficult to prove, so you have to do your best to document everything. But the holding period is not the most critical part. It's your intent. So let's talk about some things that wouldn't really qualify, and that is any property you buy with the intent to fix it up, so rehab, fix, flip, those type of activities, you're really buying the property with the intent to fix it and flip it. You're holding for sale. You're not holding for investment purposes. So those don't qualify. Now, there are ways to maybe change your intent so it would qualify, so you could buy it, fix it up, rehab it, and then hold it as rental. And now your intent is to hold for investment purposes. That would qualify. But anything held as inventory in a real estate business with the intent to rehab, fix it up, and flip it's not going to qualify technically. Condo conversions, things like that. You buy apartments, convert to condos, and sell off. Your intent is to buy, convert, and sell, so it's not held for investment. It's held for sale. Contractors, developers typically buy, build, and sell. So they're holding for sale. They're not holding for investment purposes. Now, if you buy, build, and hold as rental property, now you qualify because your intent is to hold as rental property or investment property. So, again, it all boils down to your intent, and that's really the critical issue. Second area we get a lot of confusion on is like-kind property, and people will say, well, I sold a condo, so I have to buy a condo. Absolutely not true. Like-kind in the real estate context literally means you're selling real estate, you have to buy real estate, and that's the only requirement. So on the next page of the handout, you'll see a list of like-kind properties. All of these are considered like-kind to each other. So you can exchange between all of these different asset classes, and it's considered like-kind property. So you'll see that it even includes vacant land, oil and gas interests, mineral rights, water rights. I forgot to put air rights on there, so air rights are usually considered to be real estate interests. Fractional ownership, such as tenant and common investment properties, or the DST, the Delaware Statutory Trust, all of these are like-kind to each other. It's also important to know what is not like-kind. So anything that is used for personal use, your primary residence, your second home, if you have a second home that you just stay at occasionally, if you have a vacation property, those are not considered like-kind or qualified use because they're used for personal use. So anything that's used personally is not going to qualify. Now, usually it's a combination thereof. If it's a vacation property, you rent it sometimes to vacation rentals, and they use it sometimes. So we have to look at the fact pattern and see if it would qualify. And it's relatively easy to get those to qualify if you've got time to plan around it. We talked about property held for sale doesn't qualify. Any kind of security doesn't work. Stocks and bonds and mutual funds, REITs, those are security interests. So if you're selling real estate, you can't buy a security. So we get a lot of phone calls about, can I buy a REIT? And the REITs are securities, so they don't qualify. There's one exception to that. It's rare. Very few people do it, but it's called an UPREIT. So that is a possibility. It's kind of a short step to get into a REIT, and it is tax-deferred. But there's some positives, and there's some negatives with that structure. The last three on this page is the one I want to focus on, and that is partnership interests, LLC interests, and shares in a corporation. When you own real estate in an entity, it's important to realize that you no longer own real estate. The entity owns the real estate. So we have to ask, who's the underlying taxpayer? So if it's a corporation, the taxpayer is the corporation. The individuals are just stockholders in the corporation, but they don't own real estate. The corporation does. Partnership, same thing. You as an individual don't own real estate. You own a partnership interest in the partnership, and the partnership as an entity owns the real estate. LLCs are a little different. LLCs could be single-member LLCs. That's very common. A single-member LLC is usually considered a disregarded entity, and if that's the case, it's treated as if it's the individual for tax purposes. So if you have a single-member LLC, verify with your tax advisor that it's a disregarded entity. That's the key term. And if it's disregarded, which most of them are, then it's really treated as you, so this will be an exception. If it's a multiple member LLC, that's a whole different ballgame. That's usually treated as a partnership, so same issue. So what happens is a lot of people will call and say, we're selling real estate, it's a partnership, but we all want to go different directions. And the problem is when the partnership sells the real estate, they are then distributing cash to each of the individual partners. And that is not considered a sale of real estate at the individual level. That's just a distribution of cash, and that cannot be 1031 exchanged. Now, if the partnership stays together, the partnership can absolutely do a 1031 exchange and buy other replacement property. But in most cases, when we get the phone call, the partnership does not want to stay together. They want to break up. There's probably 1,000 different possible solutions in this situation, so it depends on all the partners and all their goals and objectives and all that stuff. But this is probably the most complicated part of the 1031 world where entities are breaking up. So just want to leave you with that thought that, you know, if you've got property in an entity, we need to break it down and figure out who's the real taxpayer, who's selling the real estate, are they staying together, are they breaking up, and then we can figure out what to do from there. The next slide we've kind of already talked about, but this is on vacation property and second homes. So this is really a safe harbor that the IRS has come out with. So if you have a vacation property that you generally use personally, or if there's a second home that your family uses, if you can say that you've owned it for at least 2 years, you've rented it for at least 2 weeks, 14 days per year, and you have limited your personal use to not more than 14 days per year, you actually qualify for 1031 exchange treatment. So this is the one I was referring to where it's relatively easy to structure a 1031 exchange when it's vacation property or second homes that involve personal use. Great planning opportunity. Really surprised that the IRS came out with a favorable ruling like that, but it goes a long way in helping to convert some of your non-productive assets, do an exchange on a tax-deferred basis, and get into a productive asset that produces cash flow.
Hi, this is the operator. At the time, we have a question. Our first question comes from Jermaine. Jermaine, please state your question.
Hello, Ken. Can you hear me?
Hi, Jermaine. This is Bill. Go ahead.
Oh, Bill. I'm sorry, Bill. No problem. I got a question from a student that just emailed me, so I wanted to get this question. The student's name is Mark, and Mark says, Bill, I just opened my first 1031 for my first house on the contract, so I've learned a lot so far. The 1031 QI I'm using recommended using a land trust in order to orchestrate my 5 homes to 1 apartment building. Pretty cool idea. When an amendable seller will allow me to own a percentage of share in the final purchase of each home is closed. For example, all homes being equal, I would receive 20% ownership of the multifamily building along the ways as each property closes, so it would be 20, 40, 60 until we get to 100%. He wants to know, have you heard of this? Is this common when you have more than one house to exchange?
Good question. Wow, that was a mouthful. let me address land trusts in general. So land trusts can be a very effective strategy for 1031 exchange transactions. And the reason for that is as a land trust, you've got either one or multiple beneficiaries in a land trust. And a beneficial interest in a land trust is considered to be an interest in real estate. There's a specific IRS ruling issued back, I believe, in 1992, where the land trust was ruled upon as effective and would qualify as an interest in real estate. So you could have someone who buys into a land trust as a beneficiary, and that would be considered a purchase of real estate for 1031 purposes. And it could be a 20% interest in a specific property or the entire trust, whatever however they structure that. And it would work on the sales side as well. So he could, I'm not sure exactly what his transaction involves on the sales side, but he could sell an asset in his individual name, turn around and buy replacement property as part of the 1031 exchange by acquiring beneficial interests in either one or multiple land trusts, and that would qualify as a purchase of real estate for 1031 exchange treatment. And there's probably lots of different potential structures there. So absolutely, that would qualify.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's all he wanted
You're
to
welcome.
Know. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Anytime. In fact, the next slide is kind of along that line, which is the reinvestment requirement. And there's a lot of confusion here and a lot of misunderstanding here as well. So hopefully this will kind of, you know, spell it out. There's really two requirements. The first requirement is that you have to trade equal or up in value. Now, the question is, what value? And that's where there's the confusion. A lot of people will think that you only have to reinvest your taxable gain, or you only have to reinvest your equity, which is the cash coming out of your sale transaction, et cetera. And those are not true. It's actually the net sale price. And this is where you have to be careful. So let's say you sell property for $1 million. That's your gross sale price. We then subtract your routine selling expenses. So it's not everything on a closing statement. It's only your routine selling expenses. And that would be things like broker's commission, title insurance premiums, your closing attorney fees, your escrow fees, recording fees, exchange fees, things like that that are directly related to selling the property. Could involve attorney fees if your attorney reviewed the purchase and sale agreement. It could involve the different types of building inspections if that's a routine, normal selling expense where you're either on the sell side or the buy side, you're inspecting the property. It would not include things like operating expenses, so prorated rents, prorated property taxes, HOA fees. Things like that are expenses of operating the property. You're just paying them through closing. Now, you can do that. It doesn't hurt the exchange, but any monies that are used to pay for operating expenses, those are considered taxable. So, you know, it's usually a small number, but it's taxable. You can add up all those charges just before you close and put in out-of-pocket cash to offset those, and then it would not be taxable. Some people can do that. Some people just don't care. It's really a personal preference. The third bucket, if you will, is loan fees, loan costs, anything a lender requires. So on the sales side, if you're paying off a loan, anything, any charges, expenses, or fees related to the loan payoff are not permissible. You can use exchange funds to pay for those, but again, it will be taxable. It won't hurt the exchange, but it does create a slight taxable event. On the buy side, if you have to pay for loan fees, points, origination charges, etc., those are not permissible. You can use exchange funds to pay for it, but it creates a small taxable event. So the key is your net sale price. So if you're selling for $1 million, deduct your selling costs. Your net sale price is somewhere between, say, $900,000 and $950,000 approximately. That's the net sale price. That's what you have to reinvest. So it's not your taxable gain or profit, and it's not your equity. It's your net sale price. That's the magic number. And as long as you buy one or multiple properties equal to or greater than your net sale price, you've met that requirement. That's number one. Number two is all of your cash, all your equity that comes out of your sale transaction needs to be reinvested. Now, you could pull cash out. So if you have a cash requirement, you can pull cash out. It's not going to hurt the 1031 exchange, but you will pay tax on the amount of cash that you're pulling out. So just keep that in mind. The 1031 exchange can be a great tool for reinvesting and deferring most of your taxes, but pulling a little bit of cash out to create a cash deposit. You know, a lot of us are real estate rich but cash poor. So sometimes pulling a little cash out and paying tax to create a cash cushion is not always a bad idea. It doesn't hurt the exchange, just means you're going to pay tax on whatever cash you pull out. The third one, which is not really listed here, but it's a lot of stuff out there on the internet about replacing your debt. So let me clarify that. A lot of the articles you'll read say you absolutely have to replace your debt, and that's not true. The requirement is you trade equal or up in value, which we talked about. You reinvest all your equity, your net cash, which we talked about. The difference, so what you buy your properties for minus the cash you reinvest, is the question mark. And that can be either new loans, new debt, or it could be out-of-pocket cash. You could put more cash into the transaction. So you don't have to replace your mortgage or your debt on the property. You could replace it with out-of-pocket cash. So you do have to trade equal or up in value. You do have to reinvest your cash. The mortgage could be new debt or out-of-pocket cash. So it doesn't have to be replaced, just to kind of help clarify that. So it all boils down to your intent. If you have the intent to reinvest, you have the intent to reinvest your cash, et cetera, you'll be in good shape here.
Hi, this is the operator. We have another question coming from Lou. Lou, please state your question.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Wonderful. This is Lou from New York. First of all, thank you very much for doing this. It's very beneficial.
Sure.
Well, I have a quick question. I actually came online a little late, so I don't know if you already went over. So I just want to throw out a scenario out there and see how that works. So I have an investment property. It's a condo, right? We never live in there, and it's been we have been owning it for more than 2 years. We bought it for $280, and then now it's worth $540 or $530. Am I able to use that to purchase a commercial property?
Good question. Yes, absolutely. So it sounds like the condo you bought is held for rental. You've had it for 2 years, so it's a nice season period. You're selling it for $540, $530. You've got $280 of cost basis, so you've got a nice profit sitting there. As long as the two requirements we talked about is qualified use, which means it has to be held for rental, investment, or business use. And so the condo clearly does. Commercial property obviously would be used for business, investment, or rental purposes. And the second requirement is like kind. And you're selling real estate, which is the condo. You're buying real estate, which is commercial property. So that would absolutely qualify.
Wonderful. Awesome. That's one question that I have, too.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, the 1031 is a great way to reposition your assets from, so let's say, a condo, a single-family type property, into a totally different asset class like commercial.
Gotcha.
And not have to get hit with the taxes. So that's a perfect example.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, because I thought that a condo usually is considered as a residential, even though that we use it as an investment property. Okay, that just cleared up. Thank you very much, Bill.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you. Yeah, a lot of out there think that if you're selling a condo, you have to buy a condo, et cetera, and that's where the misinformation comes in. So like-kind literally means real estate for real estate, and that, which means any kind of real estate qualifies as like-kind property as long as it's held for rental, investment, or business use. So it's a great way to kind of diversify the portfolio. Okay, let's talk about the different 1031 exchange structures, and I briefly summarize these at the very beginning of the program. We have forward exchanges, reverse exchanges, improvement exchanges, and zero equity. Zero equity is kind of a subset of all the first three. Forward exchanges is what 97% of investors use. So you're selling first, and then you reinvest in replacement property after you sell. The reverse exchange is the opposite. You're buying first, so you actually close on your replacement properties first, and then you're selling your existing property later. And the improvement exchange means that you're buying replacement property, you have 1031 exchange funds left over, and you want to use some of those funds to build or improve the property that you're acquiring. So we're going to go through each of those real quick. They all have deadlines to worry about. So with most people, they're doing a forward exchange. They're going to sell first, and then they're going to buy later. Now, this is what 97% of the investors do. The risk with a forward exchange is you're selling first. That means you close on your sale. You've triggered your gain. So now you have your deadlines to identify replacement property and close on those purchases. If you can't identify and or close on the purchases, then it becomes a failed exchange and it becomes taxable. So that's the risk. That's where the reverse exchange can help eliminate that risk. You buy first, you close on your purchase, you've got it locked up, you know you've got it, and then you have the same time frame to sell your existing property. So reverses eliminate a lot of the risk, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but they're much more complicated, the exchange fees are a lot more, et cetera, and we'll talk about fees as well. So most people do the forward exchange because it's much simpler, much less expensive, and much more straightforward. With a forward exchange, you're selling first, and your deadlines, your 45-day identification deadline and your 180-day exchange period, both start running with the close of your sale. So it's not when you sign your contract or when you go into escrow or start anything, you know, the closing process with a closing attorney. It's when you close. And the closing is generally defined as the day that you deed the property to the buyer, and the buyer has all the benefits of ownership, the burdens, the risks, the right to use, et cetera. So that's really the trigger. That's what starts your 45 days and your 180 days. So the 45 days is exactly 45 calendar days to identify what you're going to buy. That moves very quickly. That's 6 weekends. So you got to keep in mind that's a very tight window. So when you're selling property, you're going to start a 1031 exchange. Start looking for a replacement property as early as you can. If you wait till you close and you're in cash, as we call it, 45 days is not a lot of time, especially in markets like today. There's a lot of markets that are really difficult because there's not a whole lot of inventory out there. You're getting multiple offers, bidding wars, etc. So start looking for property as soon as you can. There's three rules, actually two rules and an exception. There's a lot of misinformation here, so I want to clarify this as well. Most people use the first one. That's the three property rule. So you've sold one property. You identify three possible replacement properties. Usually the intent is to identify three, buy one, and the second and the third are backup properties. So you're allowed to identify three, and two and three are your backup. You could certainly buy all three if you wanted to. That's not a problem. The only requirement is, again, you go back to trading equal or up in value and reinvesting all your cash equity. This is just an identification rule that caps out the ID properties at no more than three. Most taxpayers use the three property rule because they're really selling one asset and they want to buy one asset, and they want to buy that one asset at greater value. Normally they're trading up in value. So they can identify three properties and it doesn't matter what the market value is. It could be, you know, $10 million if they wanted to do that, or even more. Now, some investors are the opposite. Some investors want to diversify. They want to sell one asset and buy four, five, six, seven, you know, single families or something like that. So obviously, they can't use the three property rule. So in that case, they're going to look at the 200% of fair market value rule. And literally, it's 200% of your sale price. If you sold a property, let's say it was a sale price of $1 million, then 200% would be $2 million. You can identify as many properties as you want as long as the total value is not greater than $2 million in that example. So there's no limit on the number of properties. The limit is on the value, the total value of what you can identify. So that's usually used, like I said, is when people want to diversify and buy a bunch of smaller assets and do a good job of diversification. The 95% is an exception. You have to be very careful with this. The 95% exception says we don't care how many or what value you identify. You can identify as many properties as you want. You can identify as much value as you want, as long as you actually close on 95% of the value identified. So if you identify $10 million worth of property, you've got to close on $9.5 million worth, otherwise the exchange won't qualify. So the 95% exception is really designed for a portfolio acquisition. An example, last year we had a lady who identified 40 single-family properties. She sold one and identified 40. And our first caution was, can you close on all 40? That's a big thing to bite off. Well, in this case, it was one seller, one purchase and sale agreement, one closing process, one settlement transaction. So in that case, she was very confident she was going to buy 100%, and she used the 95% exception as her identification rule. So that just kind of gives you an idea of how you can use the ID rules. The next is the 180-day exchange period. I want to be careful here. A lot of people think it's 45 plus 180. It is not. That's not the case. It's 45 days from the closing to identify your potential replacement property, plus an additional 135 days to close on your purchases for a total of 180 days. So it's 45 to identify, 180 to actually close on your purchases. It's 180 total, which includes the original 45 days to identify. There's one warning there. If you close on a sale transaction before or between October 17th and December 31st, just keep in mind that the actual due date is 180 days or the due date of your tax return, which is April 15th for most people. And that means if you close after October 17th, your 180 days might be shorter, might be less than 180 days. It's really easy to work around that. File an extension of your tax return, finish your exchange, then file your tax return. Not a big deal unless you forget to do it, then it kind of ruins your whole year. Reverse exchanges. I'm just going to cover this quickly because this is a pretty complicated topic. Reverse exchanges, like I said, allow you to buy first and then sell later. As I indicated with a regular forward exchange, if you sell first, you've triggered your gain, and then if you can't identify property or acquire it, it becomes a failed exchange. It's taxable. With a reverse, you're actually buying and closing on your purchase right off the bat, so you've got it locked up because you own it. And then you've got 45 days to identify what you're going to sell, and you've got 180 days to actually close on the sale of that property. So the same exact deadlines, 45 plus an additional 135 for a total of 180. The difference is you buy first. If for some reason you can't sell your existing property, so your reverse exchange fails, there's no tax consequences because you haven't sold anything. All you've done is bought something. Now, you'll end up owning both the purchase and the existing property you're trying to sell if the reverse exchange fails, so that's the downside. You may not want to own both, but at least you don't have any tax consequences. The challenges are that reverses are much more complicated. We, as the qualified intermediary, have to hold title to one of your properties, either the one you're buying or the one you're selling. There's different reasons why that would be done. Usually the best structure is to take title to the one that you're buying. But if there's a lender involved, they're not going to be terribly excited about that, so it's complicated. So we kind of have to go through the whole structure and figure out what would be the best for you guys. They're also more expensive, so let me talk about fees real quick. And it varies from West Coast to East Coast because there's less competition on the East Coast. So when you're talking about regular forward 1031 exchanges, on the West Coast you tend to see exchange fees somewhere in the $700 to maybe $1,200 range. Most of us who've been doing it for a long time, we're probably in the $700 to $900 range per exchange. On the East Coast, you might see that as high as $1,800 because there's less competition there. When you get into reverse exchanges, you want to be very careful. There are a few providers out there who charge really low fees, and that's scary because they're taking shortcuts, and under audit, you may have a challenge. So most of us who are doing reverse exchanges all the time, the fees are going to be somewhere in the $6,000 to maybe $9,000 range. So it gives you kind of an idea of what to look for. That's what you can expect for one sale and one purchase. That should include everything, including all the costs related to an LLC that we set up to hold title, or what the IRS calls park title, to your property. There shouldn't be any additional fees on top of that, but it'll give you kind of a flavor of what to expect there. Personally, when I do exchanges, I do reverses because they take a lot of that risk out. You buy and close on your purchase first. You just have to be prepared for all the complexities and whatnot that's involved with that. Next slide is the improvement 1031 exchange, and I'm just going to give a quick example here to kind of walk through this. Let's say you sold a property today for $1 million and went into a 1031 exchange, and you found vacant land for, say, $250,000 and decided, you know what, let's buy this and let's build something on it. So with an improvement exchange, you can sell your current property. The $1 million goes into the 1031 exchange. You use the first $250,000 cash to buy the land. And now you've got $750,000 cash left over that needs to be spent. Let's assume the project you decide to build is a $5 million project on this land. We don't care about the full $5 million from an exchange perspective. All we care about is that you sold for $1 million, so you have to replace that million. So during that 180-day exchange period, you have to reinvest $1 million. Now, you bought the dirt for $250, so we're already partway there. We've got $750 left over. So now what we have to make sure is that we spend that $750 during the 180-day period, and the construction, the improvements that are related to that $750 payment have to be completed by the end of the 180-day window. As long as we can do that, then we can say we've reinvested at least $1 million at the end of the 180-day period, and we've reinvested, and that qualifies for 1031 exchange treatment. The other $4 million of the project can be done after the fact. We don't care about that. So you don't have to be finished with the entire project. You don't have to have a certificate of occupancy or anything like that. We just have to prove to the IRS that you spent $1 million total, that the construction related to that $1 million was completed by the end of the 180 days. These obviously are much more complicated and also more expensive. They're very similar in a reverse exchange. We have to set up an LLC to hold title to the target property during the build-out. And we're cutting a little close on time, so I'm going to drop down to the last slide here, which is kind of our strategic tax planning. So I quickly gave an overview of the different types of tax strategies at the very beginning of the program today. One of the ones I mentioned was the 121 exclusion, where you could sell your home, the property you live in, and as long as you can say that you've owned it and you've lived in it for 2 out of the last 5 years, you get $250,000 tax-free per person, so $500,000 if you're married. Well, what happens if your capital gain is way over the $500,000? So I want to use a specific example here. We had a couple that were here in our backyard, so in La Jolla, California. They had bought a property in La Jolla almost 40 years ago. All of their family had moved to Florida, so family, kids, grandkids, etc., and they were having health problems, and they wanted to get back to the East Coast. But they had this primary residence. Well, today, after 40 years, it was worth over $8 million. So their capital gain was almost the full $8 million. They bought it for almost nothing. So if they sold it as a husband and wife, they would have gotten $500,000 tax-free, but $7.5 million of that would have been taxable, and they couldn't do that. That would have killed them. So the first one is Revenue Procedure 2005-14. I'm taking the second one first. So what that means is the IRS has come out with a ruling that allows you to move out of your primary residence, convert it to rental property. So this goes back to being able to prove your intent to hold for rental. And so in this case, what they did, they moved out of the property, they rented it for 24 months, and then they had one more year after that to market the property, sell it, and close, and still get the $500,000 tax-free exclusion. But they can also do a 1031 exchange now because the last 24 months it has been held as a rental property. So their intent was to rent. They can prove it because they've got 24 months of rental activity. So when they sell the property, they get the $500,000 tax-free income because they can say they've lived in it for 2 out of the last 5 years, and they did a 1031 exchange. So $500,000 tax-free, $7.5 million tax-deferred into rental property that they bought back in Florida, and they were able to move back and be with their family. So this revenue procedure is a phenomenal opportunity for people who live in a highly appreciated area where the capital gain might be way over the $250,000 or $500,000 limit. It can also work the other way around. So you may have rental property and you want to get some of that income tax-free. You can kick the tenants out, move into the property, convert it to your primary residence. Now, this has changed a little bit. It used to be you just move in, live there for 2 years, and then after the two-year window, sell the property and get the $250,000 or $500,000 tax-free. Now they've changed the law. They changed this back in 2008. so that if you had it as investment property first and then you convert it to your primary residence, the gain is prorated between the number of years that you live in it versus the number of years that you've rented out. So it's not going to be 100% tax-free like it used to be, but the longer you live there, the more of the gain will be considered tax-free than taxable. So there's some great planning opportunities here to combine the 121 exclusion with a 1031 exchange, depending on which side of the fence you're on and what have you. Lots of opportunity there. And with that, that was kind of a whirlwind tour of 1031 exchanges. So I'll turn it back over to you, and if we can certainly take any questions that they might have out there.
All right. That was a lot of good stuff. Woo. Yeah,
it's like drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a great opportunity using 1031s. Operator, do we have anyone in the queue? If there's a delay, then she might be picking up some names. So if you want to ask
at the moment, we have no callers with questions.
Okay. All right. So, and Bill, you can give out your contact information to everyone. Because
sure.
I know once they review this information, they'll probably be contacting you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd be happy to chat with you. And if you have a specific strategy you want to brainstorm with, be happy to chat with you about that, too. I'm out of the San Diego headquarters office, so you can call me at area code 619-239-3091. So that's 619-239-3091. Or if you want to email me, you can certainly do that. It's wexeter@exeterco.com. Or the website is just exeter1031.com. So exeter1031.com.
This is the operator. We have a caller with a question.
Okay.
Coming from Alicia. Alicia, please go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Very interesting information about the 1031. I have a little question for you.
Sure.
If you have a piece of property and it becomes a rental, and then you move back into it, how do you prove intent that it was never meant to be a rental in the first place? You're saying that you have to prove to be that it was, I'm mixing it up. I'll give my situation. We have a rental. We have a house. We had to rent it out because we got shipped to Japan.
Okay.
And then, so it became a rental. It was originally our resident. And then, so we're now back in it. So am I going to have to prove how many years I've been in it, or does that not qualify because it was never intended to be a rental?
Good question.
Okay.
My favorite answer is it depends. My staff goes crazy with that. Every time I turn around, it depends. In this case, it was a primary residence, then converted to a rental property, and then converted back to a primary residence. So
correct.
The first thing we look at is if you were to sell it today and you close on the sale today, you look back 60 months, which is 5 years. So if you can look back 60 months and say that you have lived in the property for a total of 24 months out of the 60, and it doesn't have to be consecutive. It might have been, 6 months first and then 18 months later or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can show mm-hmm. that you lived in it for 24 months out of the last 60 months, then you qualify for the 121 exclusion, and it won't matter that it was a rental in the middle.
Okay.
If you don't qualify, if there's been too much time in the middle, then you're going to have to wait till you can say you've lived in it for that 24-month period. Otherwise, you're going to have potentially issues there. Now, you said you moved or relocated to outside the country. Was that due to employment or military, anything like that?
Military, yes. It's military.
Okay. There are some exceptions and exclusions for military service. So the 121 exclusion does have some special exclusions for military service. So what I would do is take your fact pattern into your CPA and say, here's, when we moved out of the primary residence, it was for military service, and the holding period essentially gets placed on hold for a period of time because of the military service. So your fact pattern will be different than most investors who just have to look at the 24 month out of 60 months. You might be able to have some favorable treatment there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Does that have to do with enlisted military, or is that civil service, DOD?
I believe I'm the 121 is a little outside my area of expertise, but I believe if it is done for military service, whether it's in civil service or actually enlisted, I believe you qualify for the preferential treatment. But I'm not 100% sure on that, so have your accountant do some quick research. Or for those who want to research it on your own, it falls under Section 121 of the tax code, or the, what we call the 121 exclusion, and the regulations would be Section 1.121 in the Treasury regulations.
Okay, great. IRS, good old IRS code. Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
I did come in a little bit late. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I did come in a little bit late, and I didn't catch your name.
First name is Bill, and the last name is Exeter.
Okay. I'm right down the street from you, Bill.
Oh, terrific. If you ever want to come by, just come on by, and we'd be happy to chat with you.
That'd be great. I'll give you a call first.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate all
You're
your
welcome. My pleasure. Anytime.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Do we have any other questions?
Up next, we have Carlos. Carlos, please go ahead.
Hi, Bill.
Carlos. How are you doing? I'm good.
I'm doing fine. Listen, a lot of great information. I've got a unique situation where I was left at home. Parents' home left to me. I was not living in it when it was left to me, so I turned it into a rental. The Prop 13 out here in California makes it really not worth my money to sell at this point. But at some point, I want to. Since you mentioned the prorated formula, would my years of living in the house prior to me having it be titled in my name be counted towards prior satisfaction of that prior prerequisite?
So I assume that when you lived in the house, it was still owned by your parents at that point?
Correct.
Okay. That should not be held against you. It's only when you actually own the property. So once you inherited the property, that's where your time limit's going to start running.
Oh, so my time that I lived in the house as a youth won't count as years of won't count towards that prerequisite then.
That's correct. Yeah, because at that point it wasn't your property. I mean, you lived there, but it was really your parents' property. So it doesn't start running until you actually own the property.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure. Anytime.
Okay, who's next?
Up next, we have Carl. Carl, please state your question.
Hi, Carl.
Hi. I want to give you two quick questions,
okay.
Hopefully. One is, first one is, when I do 1031 exchanges, and I have a certain amount of money that at some point is taxable,
okay.
And I become deceased. And this now goes to my beneficiaries, and they change the government, whoever, the IRS, changes the tax base on that. So does that mean that my beneficiaries then who inherit this property can continue that 1031 into the future?
Yes, absolutely. So you've exchanged over and over and over, and then you pass on. Your beneficiaries inherit the property, and that's when they get that step up in cost basis. So, and this will go back to an example I used before. You know, let's say you bought it for $100,000 today; it's worth $1 million. When you pass on, your beneficiaries' cost basis will get stepped up or increased to the fair market value at the date of your death. So it would get stepped up to the $1 million. So literally, they now own a property worth $1 million with a cost basis of $1 million. They could sell it the next day and pay zero taxes. Or they can continue to hold it, and effectively their cost basis starts all over again. It's stepped up to the current fair market value. They can depreciate the entire property all over again, so the depreciation starts all over. And they would only be concerned about any gain after your date of death. So any gain prior to the date of death would just go away with that step up, and only the profit or the gain after your death would count toward the beneficiaries.
Okay. And is there any length of time, some period that you can only have a 1031 amount of money in effect for?
In terms of owning the property, you mean, or?
Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, you could. Oh, go ahead.
Liability still exists.
Yes, that's the only time the gain or the profit, if you will, goes away is at date of death. So as long as you keep exchanging, you will never incur the taxable gain. But if you ever stop exchanging, you just sell and cash out, at that point you're going to recognize all of your tax consequences. Or you do a partial exchange. So maybe you sell for $1 million, you buy for $900,000, you trade down by $100,000, and only the $100,000 would be taxable. So there's different ways to take advantage of the exchange depending on what your goals and objectives are.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Okay. Who's next?
Up next, we have Sabrina. Sabrina, please state your question.
Hi, this is Sabrina calling from Southern California. I have a question regarding a property that we lived in for 6 years, and due to the loss of job, we had to put the house for rent. Now, a year and a half ago, we moved back into the house because the house we were living in, we had to short sell it due to loss of job, and the property declined in value. So
okay.
Do we qualify for tax defer program?
Good question. So you lived in it for 6 years, and when did you move out at that point and rent the property?
In 2003.
Yeah,
it was
rental. How long did you hold it as a rental?
From 2003 till June of 2015.
2015, okay. And now you've lived in it for 1.5 years.
Yes.
Okay. So the 1031 exchange would not apply because it's currently held as your primary residence. And so they look at your current intent. So since you've lived there for a year and a half, that's clear that it's your primary residence. So the 1031 exchange would not qualify. So really, you've got another half year to go, and then you'll qualify for the 121 exclusion. But they're going to prorate the gain between the number of years that you rented it versus the number of years you live in it. So you'd want to live there for enough time where you get a big chunk of your gain allocated to tax-free status as opposed to taxable status.
How do we do that? How long do we stay?
Just the longer. So let's say you move into it, and actually the only time that's going to be counted against you is be anything after 2008, so 2009 and forward. So you're going to have 2009, 10, 11, 12, all the way through 2015. That's a rental period. And then
mm-hmm.
anything after that is going to be your primary residence. So the longer you live there, the higher the percentage is allocated to tax-free income.
Okay.
So if you live there for, another, say, 12 years, then 50% would be taxable. Actually, that's not quite so, because that goes back to 2003. If you count 2009 to 2015, and then you live there for the same number of years as your primary residence, then half the gain would be taxable and half the gain would be tax-free, since it was a 50-50 split. So the longer you live there, the more income will be tax-free.
Okay. So why are we considering from 2009 till 2015?
Because the tax code changed in 2008, so any usage prior to 2009 is not factored into the equation. It's only 2009 and afterward that they count.
So if I live there for another 6 years total, so that should wipe out any taxes? Because I lived
there 6 years
and before.
Yeah, you rented it for 6 years, and then you lived there for 6 years, so that's 50-50. So 50% would be taxable, and 50% would be tax-free.
Oh, okay.
So it's the rental period from 2009 to 2015. Those
years
are counted as rental, and then 2016
mm-hmm.
forward is counted as your primary residence. So if you're 6 years as rental, 6 years as a primary residence, then 50% is tax-free, 50% would be taxable.
Oh, I see. Okay. All righty. Thank you. Thank you so much, Bill.
Sure. My pleasure.
Okay. I got an emailed in question right here for you, Bill. Are you ready?
Sure. I'm ready.
All right. All right. I have a vacant land on which I plan to develop a rental property ASAP. When can I sell mineral rights in 1031 into the new rental project? Must I wait until it's placed in service, or can I use the proceeds of my 1031 to construct the rental?
Ooh, good question. It sounds like the vacant lot is already owned by the person. So at this point, they already own the property, and it sounds like they want to sell some mineral rights and use the proceeds from the mineral rights to pay for the improvements on the vacant land. That gets into a really advanced 1031 exchange topic. Generally, when you're 1031 exchanging, you're selling an existing property. You 1031 exchange into property that you do not already own. So you have to sell something you do own, you buy something you don't own, and that's where the exchange comes from. So in most cases, the people that you ask will say you can't do what you're trying to do. However, the IRS has issued 3 private letter rulings that effectively allowed someone to sell property they have and use the proceeds to build on property they already own. So in theory, it is possible. The problem is we only have 3 private letter rulings. And the issue there is a private letter ruling, for those who haven't been involved with those before, is a specific taxpayer has their attorney and CPA write to the IRS and say, this is exactly what I'm going to do. Will this qualify? And the IRS will come back and say yes or no. So that's a private letter ruling. And the person who asked for the private letter ruling can rely upon it, and their transaction cannot be challenged as long as they do exactly what they said they were going to do. But then you or I could do exactly the same thing, and the IRS could disqualify the transaction. Even though we have 3 private letter rulings to rely upon, we can't quote those as precedent or cite those as precedent. So it's still possible that our transaction would be disqualified. It would be unlikely because we could say, here's 3 private letter rulings. We did exactly what they say, but there's always going to be risk. So there's 2 levels of answer here. The first is no, because you have to buy something you don't already exist. The second answer is yes, we have 3 rulings that allow it, and I don't think we have time to get into that detail today. But if you want to respond and give them my contact information, I could walk them through the advanced part of this and see if they're interested in that. But it will not be for the faint of heart.
Okay, I could do that. All right, operator, do we have any other questions?
At the moment, we have no callers with questions.
All right, well, I think we're going to end the call right now. Man, those questions started coming in, huh, Bill? As soon as you gave out your contact information, I was like, woo, the floodgates opened up, which was good. You know, there was a lot of good questions there.
Absolutely, that's great.
Yeah. I want to thank you for being on the call. It was, like, great.
My pleasure, anytime, and be happy to chat with anybody with any follow-up stuff. Just feel free to call or email.
All right. With that, we're going to end the call today, so... It was a great call. The recording is going to be placed up on the coaching website in the next day. So you'll be able to go up there and then listen to it. And then you can contact Bill and grill him. All right? That sound good, Bill?
Sounds good to me.
Right on. All right. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for being on the call. Take care.
You bet. Take care. Bye-bye.